So we're at this big turning point. That's why I was so excited to talk with you today, because like myself alone, and I know that a lot of other people can relate to this, I'm at this point now where it's like, okay, trying to figure out our true cost overhead. What's our overhead? You know, we spent the last 3 years buying a crap ton of machinery. Now we're in a brand new office. We got this mortgage for an office. We need more work to feed the beast. You know, what percentage is our overhead? So am I splitting overhead into administrative and operational? So it's fixed and variable, and I'm going down. And like right now, I just feel like my head, you know, going to explode with all these numbers, because I'm at this turning point of like, okay, we need to be more profitable. Because you could brag all day and say, you know, we do $9 million a year. Well, that's great. How profitable are you off that $9 million though? Welcome back, everybody, to the ConExpo Colony Podcast. I am your host, Taylor White. As always, this podcast is brought to you by our good friends over at Komatsu. Today with me, I have somebody who I am super excited to chat to. I've been kind of geeking all morning over actually getting to sit down and talk to this man. On the internet, he's known for, you know, Blum Contracting, growing a business from 4 million to 40 million, being a leader, what it takes to be a leader. And now he is CFO over at BuildWit. So Randy Blount, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here. Excited to talk about the dirt world. And like I was telling you beforehand, to geek out on anything financial or training. Just love to talk to people who are passionate about making the dirt world a better place.
Yeah, man. That's kind of, you know, what our thing has been. And I've been chatting with Aaron over the years too. And it's kind of always been, you know, working on the culture and all that stuff and figuring out, you know, what makes my business, Kenway Construction, stand out and retain the people. But before we dive deep into the numbers and all that stuff, maybe for the people listening at home, I'd love to get you to give a little bit of a rundown of, you know, who you are and what you do.
I was like many people who are in the industry. I was 17 when my father decided he wanted to start his own company. And so like my senior year of high school, I helped my father estimate from the kitchen table while he was starting to build a company. After I graduated high school, I worked for about a year with my dad. And then I went on a mission for my church. And then returning, I actually didn't think I was going to be in the dirt world. I went to college, thought I was going to go do something else. And my dad got sick. And so I kind of jumped in and started helping out the business. I think I was like my senior year of college. And I remember I was talking to a buddy who was working at the Federal Reserve. I was in a finance program and he was at the Federal Reserve and he was telling me about how boring his day was. And I was thinking about like, you know, I was working nearly full time most of my college career. I was thinking, I don't remember a boring day in construction. And it kind of just got me thinking, maybe there's something more here than what I thought. Started taking a little bit more active role in the business. After my father's passing, I took over as vice president of the company and then eventually bought my mom out. And we grew that into from about 4 million to about 40 million in revenue. We were acquired by the Clyde Companies, who it's a large company, like 4,600 employees in the Intermountain West. Good family owned company. Stuck around there for 2 years and we grew to about 100 million in revenue over those next 2 years. It was kind of a culmination of having additional capital, the market being really good for growth, and the Southwest really expanding. Mega projects, data centers, microchip factories. We're landing contracts that were more than our yearly revenue just a year or two before. So it was a cool experience for me being acquired. I learned a lot. I got to learn what we were doing that was really smart and what big companies are doing that's really smart. And then since then, I've been able to consult mostly east of the Mississippi with a fair amount of companies and share with them what I've learned and see what they're doing. And it's been really fun.
That's impressive. You skipped over a little bit. Like, I just want to touch and make sure that I say that. Sorry to hear about your father as well. To have that happen at such a young age kind of throws you into the fire and makes you grow up real quick, I think, probably,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was, you know, we actually at BuildWit, we had a team member who recently lost their dad. And I told him, like, it's been 11 and a half years. It still hurts. Time does have a way of healing those wounds. And now I can look back and mostly cherish the good memories and also reflect on what was learned. I can see, you know, for me, I'm a religious person. So I feel like I can see the hand of God and kind of everything the way it fell. But yeah, being 26, my dad passed away while he was 50. So it was quite unexpected. I tell people all the time, some people say smart. I'm on this call with a smart guy. And I tell them, I'm not sure if I'm smart. I think I'm just too dumb to quit. And so because of that, I learned stuff because I just kept running at the same wall until I figured out how to knock it down.
Learn by your mistakes, right? We make so many mistakes here in my business all the time. Constantly sitting at a round table that we have every Wednesday, figuring out what the hell did we do last week because that didn't work. So how are we going to make it work now? But I mean, the ultimate thing for you, right, is getting to, you know, you had this situation happen with your father, unfortunately, and then here it is. Hey, you know, you grow the family business. That is a great way to honor, you know, your family and your father. So that's super impressive.
I also think like, you know, I've told this other team member at Buildwit who lost their father, like, you know, growing the business was definitely a part of it. But then also just one of the things I try and do, and my dad had a really big heart. He was the quintessential earthwork guy, bigger guy, big beard, but just had a big heart. And so I was telling him, I always try and honor his legacy when I can by just being kind when I can to whoever possible. And growing the business was definitely a way to honor his legacy. But the actions, you know, us as human beings, I think sometimes speaks louder.
Yeah, 100%. Where did this love for the growing the business? I mean, obviously, you know, you're kind of just in a roundabout way saying that, but you went to school. Sorry, what did you take in school?
So my degree's in, it's funny, the program I was in, it changed while I was there. So I have a business administration / agribusiness finance.
Okay, interesting.
I've always enjoyed business and I've always enjoyed numbers. It's kind of the way I think. And so it was really fun to go do that. And I thought I was going to be a commodity trader. This is kind of what I thought. I did some trading strategies in some of my upper level college classes, and I thought it was really fun. And then ultimately, in some ways, bidding and doing earthwork is similar to trading in the stock market. It's like understanding risk.
The risk.
Pricing the risk accordingly. Sometimes it's having the confidence to hold your position when maybe everyone else around you is not.
Oh, yeah. The weighing out the risk is very, you know, my father-in-law, he's a private wealth investor. So I always joke and say, you know, he's a professional gambler. But, you know, it's almost like the same here with my estimator. You know, we're pricing a big project right now. And it's just like, there is so much risk and so much weighs on an estimator at a company because ultimately the company's trajectory or how well they do or not how is in their hands with the pricing. Obviously, it goes down to the super and the everyone else to execute the job accordingly. But it's a big role. How long were you an estimator? Were you actively always an estimator with Blunt? Like, I know you started probably as an operator and then worked your way up, but the estimating part of it, was that something that you kind of always had a hand in? Because where we are in our business, I feel like you still never lose that kind of, okay, well, let's see the numbers. Let's see where we're landing on this. Let's all review this project.
Yeah. So my dad, he's a big believer in if you're going to run a company, you should do everything at the company. And so like if we took on a new scope, even up until the time we were acquired, if we started to do something new, I would make sure I'd go spend some days in the field with the guys who were doing the work to make sure I really understood what it's like to break bags of grout into a hopper for the soil and L walls, or what it's like to be at the end of the hose when you're doing shotcrete or laying pipe. So yeah, I've done it all. I did spend a lot of time as an estimator, especially like even as an executive, you know, we had a bid review process. So I was reviewing every estimate with a team up until the time I decided to resign from WW Clyde. And so I think you never really get away from it. Even like some of our parent companies, like presidents of most of our subsidiaries at that really large company were also involved in the bid review process. And I think it's because like, it doesn't matter how good your operational team is. If you get a bad estimate, like it is really, really hard to overcome a bad estimate. Now, you can be super innovative and you can make a job more profitable, or you can overcome some mistakes in an estimate, but you make a mistake that's a couple million dollars on a $10 to $12 million job, you're probably not making that up.
No.
So I think you kind of always are involved in the estimating process. And some of that's just experience, right? Like towards the end of that, my run there at Blunt, I started going back to see all the projects that I had been involved in. And the last I counted, it was like over 500 projects, ranging from, you know, a few thousand dollars to like $20 million. Right at the end, we got a $100 million project as I was leaving. We did it for about a year. So 550 plus projects from $10,000 contract value up to 100 million plus. And that's hard to replace. So I think that's part of the reason that you're always involved is you're sharing the experience that you've gained over years.
I would totally agree with that. And the one thing that we're like, why I asked that question is just because I find that it's hard sometimes letting the control go. I feel like, you know, because you always, you know, being more profitable is the main thing right now for us. Anyways, the past 3-4 weeks of my life has basically just been diving into, and I'm not a financial guy. The guys in the office joke. Yeah, you know, I'm a psych guy. You know, I have the privilege of like, I'm third generation business. Took it from a 6 to 7 figure business. And I've been fortunate enough to, you know, hire people in positions that where I'm dumb because I'm the first person to understand and realize, hey, this isn't good. I'm not good at this. There's somebody who's better than me at this. For me, it's just been kind of trying to figure out, okay, because right now I feel like we're missing the CFO or a controller or like somebody who's a CPA, like a registered accountant. Like, I just don't know because business, the financials have outgrown myself and my father. And it's just like, what is our next step? Because I'm trying to figure out how we're going to be more profitable and how we're going to do things. So we're at this big turning point. And that's why I was so excited to talk with you today because like myself alone, and I know that a lot of other people can relate to this. I'm at this point now where it's like, okay, trying to figure out our true cost overhead. What's our overhead? You know, we spent the last 3 years buying a crap ton of machinery. Now we're in a brand new office. We got this mortgage for an office. We need more work to feed the beast. You know, what percentage is our overhead? So am I splitting overhead into administrative and operational? So like fixed and variable, and I'm going down and like, right now, I just feel like my head's, you know, going to explode with all these numbers because I'm at this turning point of like, okay, we need to be more profitable because you could brag all day and say, you know, we do $9 million a year. Well, that's great. How profitable are you off that $9 million though? So that's what I'm trying to figure out right now. So can you tell that I'm a little above my head right now?
I don't know about that. I think you're like many in the industry. We actually have talked a lot about, we have a training program at BuildWit that we offer, but we've talked about potentially putting together a webinar series because there are so many people who love the dirt world, love what they do, but there comes a time where you kind of move into these uncharted territories where you have to operate it differently. Job costing becomes really important and the ability to job cost your equipment to each project and the importance of phase codes and understanding what is G&A or, you know, real overhead, what's indirect cost and how do you make sure your indirect costs get to your job and what's the right process for that. And projections is what gets people, caught up a lot. So the way projections work is based off the cost that you incurred in that month and the profitability you should have in all your projects. Each month, you really need to be doing a work in progress or an over and under calculation. Nobody really talks about this or really prepares somebody for this, but it's one of the traps that really catches construction workers or construction companies, right? So imagine I had a $500,000 bill month.
So your receivables are 500K.
Yep. I billed 500,000 for the month, but I only had $140,000 in cost. But the cost of doing the work was like more like 400,000. But I had an asphalt bill that didn't hit in that month. I had a concrete bill that didn't hit in that month. Maybe I forgot to put my depreciation in or something. So I only had $140,000 in costs. So you pull a profit and loss statement and you're like, I made $360,000 last month. And you start making decisions of how you're going to deploy that $360,000 in the business, buying new assets, maybe giving bonuses. The next month, you bill another $500,000. So you have another killer month. But this month, all of those $360,000 in costs that didn't hit last month hit, plus the regular $400,000 in costs. And now all of a sudden, you have $400,000 in costs from this month and the $360,000 in costs from the previous month that didn't hit. And turns out you lost $260,000.
Now your book for that month's showing that you lost $260,000.
And you've spent the cash potentially because you thought you made so much.
You've already spent it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that process of projections, projecting what the cost to complete the project are, and then doing what they call an over and under adjustment becomes a really key component to making sure you know really how profitable the business is.
Okay. Understand, I have been doing that. So recently what I've been diving into, so before I started, so for the past week, what I did is I opened an Excel spreadsheet and I've been trying to figure out exactly how much my triaxle truck cost me to drive down the road per hour, how much my tandem, how much my other truck specific to each driver and their pay wage driving. My 325 excavator, my 336, my roller, my skid steers, figuring out the true cost of what it takes to actually make that machine go based on, okay, there's this many working hours that it's probably going to do in the month based on this. So that was kind of the first step. Then the second thing was figuring out, okay, so, you know, what's our account payables at? What's our receivables at? Okay, how much more work do we plan on doing the rest of the month? And then what are my costs to doing that work? And then adding all that up. And then at the end, kind of trying to see what's left. But I think where I'm at is sometimes I'm getting all this information, but my big thing is I need to be incorporating my true overhead costs. How do you find out your overhead cost? Because it's all your numbers that don't change based on operation, correct?
Yeah. So overhead costs is a broad term, and it can be made up of kind of two categories. It can be made up of what they call SG&A, sales, general and administrative, and indirect costs. And the reason that it's important to recognize the two is because SG&A, from a GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, should never be charged to a job, and they should show up after gross profit. So it's kind of it's below the job level line. Whereas indirect expenses can be charged to a job. And so you might be asking, like, well, what's the difference between an indirect and an overhead expense? It's like stuff that you know is maybe hard to cost to a job, but is specifically being bought for a job. So it's some companies that might be like, hey, I have a surveyor on staff, or I have a guy who builds models and he goes out and visits sites, but it's hard to track exactly where his hours go. Or I have a PM who's managing all of my projects, and how do I put his hours right? So those would be indirect costs. You would go and say, okay, what are all the things that if I didn't have a project, I wouldn't need? So, you know, if I didn't have any work, I probably wouldn't need this estimator or this surveyor. I probably wouldn't need a project manager. So those are indirect costs. They're the cost of doing the work. Then you have like your overhead, which you can often make the same argument for, but your overhead would be like administrative staff. So people who are at the front desk, people who might be, you know, a controller or somebody who's doing finance functions. It also could be like your insurance.
Yeah, I have that in there too much.
I have all these insurance costs. I want to put those in my overhead. Some would argue your insurance cost, a good portion of them are workers' compensation, and that should be built into the wage of the employee and charged to your clients. And I'm in that boat. But
I think our P&L breaks it up. It breaks up the insurance, like within the insurance line item, it actually breaks it up.
Yeah. So the best way, in my opinion, to figure out your overhead cost is to go through and kind of go through like everything that's a cost that you know is not part of a job and work through all of that. And get a number and say like, okay, that number is based off of this much revenue. So our office staff and all of the overhead and indirect will be this much for 2024. And in 2024, our goal is to do this much in revenue. And what you'll then be able to do is create a percentage, right? Like, hey,
divide that number into your gross revenue.
Yep. Yep. And I have a percentage. And then when you're estimating projects,
what should that be? Sorry.
You're good. So one thing that I think is really cool is this is a plug for CFMA, Construction Financial Management Association. CFMA, they post key metrics. And so they actually have metrics around like, what should that be? It obviously varies by region. It varies by company size. It varies by specific scope. But I would say overhead, not indirect.
True overhead.
Should be between 5 and 10%. Okay.
Now, what do you do if you're way more than that right now?
My guess is you have a lot that's indirect that you're calling overhead.
Okay.
And the reason that you want to get indirect to the job is you don't want everyone to have a false sense of profitability on a project. So like I'll hear stuff like, oh man, my overhead's 18%. And then I'll say, well, what's your gross profit margin? Like it's around 34% or something. Like, okay, well, you're not 34% gross profit, and you're also not 18% overhead. Like, you probably have 10% that you think's overhead that's really supposed to be at the job level. And so your gross profit would be closer to that, you know, 24% number. And then when you apply your 8% overhead, now you're at a more realistic percentage for profit.
Yeah, for true, like net profit.
For net profit, yep, net income, yep. So true overhead, I would say between 5 and 10% is a good target for most site development contractors.
But that metric, like, trust me, I've been diving into this. I am higher than that.
But so, you probably also include indirect expenses in that, is my guess.
I don't know if I am. I've been pretty good at figuring out, like, what is, like, is this a direct cost to if we have more work, if we don't? But the number changes.
Like an example of this is like mechanics. Mechanics end up in overhead a lot in companies. But in my opinion, and in most large companies, the mechanic is built into your equipment costs. The cost of them is in the equipment cost, which gets charged to the job. And then like depreciation, sometimes depreciation will be seen as like, hey, that is a G&A expense, but you can make sure that your equipment rates include that depreciation cost so that your jobs are paying for it. And then there's a contra account. So
because I do have my depreciation in my administrative.
And you should.
Okay.
Yeah, you should, but it can be offset by revenue, equipment revenue. And you're small enough a size, you probably don't have an equipment department on your balance sheet or on your income statement. And
no,
probably don't have an equipment financial, but at some point you'll grow into the point where you want an equipment financial. And you'll see revenue and you'll see all those costs. So you can say, is my equipment being profitable or am I losing or making money on it?
That's interesting. So for instance, a question. So like, okay, so like my mortgage for my office, administrative.
Yes.
Property taxes, administrative.
Yes.
Insurance for my business, for all my machinery and my and everything, my blanket insurance, administrative.
You can make an argument that that's indirect. And the reason being is it's for equipment, right? And equipment's being charged to the job. So
shit, I didn't think of that.
So what some people would do is when they figured out their equipment rates and they were charging the equipment to the job, they would include the insurance cost there. And then on your profit and loss, your chart of accounts, like on your chart of accounts, you might have a section that I have no idea what your chart of accounts looks like, but say you have like a 5,000 series of account codes.
Yes, we do.
That's not being used, or 4,000 that's not being used.
Okay.
You may set up a set of those series that's like for equipment specifically. So like anything that shows up in this 4,000 series is going to be for equipment. So I'm going to have equipment, I'm going to have tires, I'm going to have all these different costs, and they can go strictly there. And then that can be then charged to the projects. The more complicated construction software has a whole fixed asset program. So like when your time card comes in, your people are being charged to the job, and then the equipment's being charged to the job with the same rate. And then all the costs are being charged to the equipment. So that's a good example of something that, you know, equipment insurance, you know, inland marine, general liability, all these things that you have on your equipment could be going to the job.
And then this is my last thing for, cause I love, this is so awesome to hear, for me to hear. So then payments on machinery. Is that an administrative overhead, or is that, should that be in my indirect?
Well, so technically it should be in nowhere. Okay. And the reason being is your depreciation should be the cost, right? So a payment is a,
because the jobs are paying for the machine.
Well, so a payment is like a balance sheet item. You buy it and you have a note, and the note sits there. As you pay it, you're paying back the note and an interest expense. So the interest expense could be G&A, and the depreciation that you're paying could be G&A, but the full payment itself should not be. So only the insurance portion and the depreciation. And depreciation is interesting because so often when it comes to depreciation, especially in recent years with Section 179 in the US, people take advantage of depreciating an asset out quicker to reduce their tax liability. You have book depreciation and you have tax depreciation, and they can be different. Generally speaking, when you're running a business, construction business, you want to have a book depreciation. You don't want to have your tax depreciation be what hits your financial statement. What I mean by that is if you maybe said like, hey, we made $300,000 this year, but we wiped out all of our profitability through additional depreciation. Well, now that depreciation is no longer on your income statement. So next year you have no depreciation to take because you don't buy any new assets. So what will happen is your income statement, you'll be like zero profitability, really profitable, zero profitability, really profitable. And it has these big swings. So obviously I'm not a CPA and I have to have that as a caveat. Talk to your CPA though, because there's wisdom in setting up a depreciation that falls in line with GAAP. So, you know, straight line depreciation, 5 to 7 years is like pretty good term range for a lot of equipment. And using that for your books, if you want to do stuff for tax purposes, that can be kind of separate and you can work with your CPA on it to keep those separate. So that I call it managerial accounting. The whole idea behind what all the financial professionals are supposed to be doing for a construction company is helping you understand how to manage your business. So what is my revenue? What is my cost? And your depreciation of a piece of equipment in real managerial terms doesn't do this, right? It doesn't go up and down, up and down. That's taking advantage of a tax code.
How do you know all this? Like, do you love this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think if you ask them at BuildWit, because I came in to help out from a CFO standpoint, I think they'd probably all tell you, like, it's just the way I think. Like, I get it. It's just like a God-given talent, and it's just how I think. And I think because of it, I enjoy it. So I wish I could say, like, I did something spectacular to have this, but it's mostly like, I enjoy it. I love to read. I read a ton and I try and stay up on this. Now, the thing that's crazy is it's always changing. So like a few years ago, you could do what they called a 1031 exchange on equipment, similar to like the real estate exchange. Like I think a year or two ago, we traded in equipment and it was post-acquisition. And they're like, yeah, you're going to have this taxable gain on this sale of the equipment. I'm like, no, just do a 1031 exchange. You're like, no, that expired with some of the Trump tax changes. And so it is hard to stay up on. So a good tax professional, a good CPA is always a good friend to have.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that I'm at the point where I don't maybe not necessarily need the overhead of paying for an in-house CPA, but I definitely somebody, controller or somebody, so I can focus on the stuff that I know that I'm more useful at. I mean, this stuff is useful because now we're understanding our true cost of machinery and learning, okay, is it making sense when we talked about we needing an extra skid steer this summer? Do we buy one or are we just going to rent one for the summertime? Because we're talking about at our peak when we're running super, super hot and things are great. But hey, now we're in December and I don't need, guess what? I don't need a third skid steer. I don't need three of them right now.
So, you know, like, can you picture a bell curve, right? It kind of flat, comes up high, then it kind of
everyone
flat.
Always buys up here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm trying and not so, to do that now.
So having like a 70%, you know, maybe 70% is a fairly good target. Like, hey, I'm going to own 70% of my equipment and I'm going to rent the other 30%. Probably not a bad like target. Each industry and each business is going to vary a little bit, but it's probably not a bad target. Taylor, one other thing I would say is like, one of the things that I think was a really interesting and probably business changing metric was revenue per employee. When I first heard it, I'm like, that is stupid. Like, I could have a ton of material on a job or a lot of subcontractors. Like, that's kind of a silly metric. But over about 4 years, we actually came to like really love this metric of revenue per employee. Once again, it changes based off the size and type of work that you're doing. So it can be probably as low as $15,000 in revenue per employee per month. You know, we were trying to do over $40,000 in revenue per employee per month towards the end. CFMA has quite a bit of data on this, different company sizes. I would say somewhere around that $30,000 in revenue per month is a pretty good number, or it's easier to think of $360,000 per year. The reason that
okay,
this...
So you're talking per month. Okay. Because yes. I've heard this metric before and people have said, and we're Canadian, $250,000. I mean, this was 5 years ago that I heard this for the first time. Okay. So when you say 30, you're talking monthly. So about 360 yearly.
Yeah. The reason I'm breaking into monthly is I want you to think through how this could help you managing the business. So as you win projects and you start kind of estimating your billings, right? You're looking out in a goal, you're looking out 2, 3, 4. We try to have 4 months of projections of our billings for the next 4 months. Obviously, the smaller you are, the smaller your projects, the harder that is to do.
Yeah.
But we try to project like, oh, hey, we're going to be billing this much for the next 4 months. Then imagine if I said, hey, on average, we want to be billing $30,000 per employee per month. In 2 months from now, I know that my revenue is going to go from $2 million to $3 million. I'm going to increase my revenue by $1 million a month. I can now take that 30,000 number and say $1 million divided by 30,000. I need about 30 more employees in 2 months.
Wow.
And now all of a sudden you have time to react. You know, instead of that phone call from everybody, like, hey, I need 5 people. I need 6 people. I need 3 people. And it starts letting you like pre-plan, look forward. We also did a 5-year plan for our growth. And 5-year plans are really like a plan, you know, like who knows if it's actual happen, but it's helped us put into perspective like, hey, we want to grow this much over 5 years. And for us to do that, we would use that revenue per employee. And we'd say like, okay, we need this many people this year, this many people that year. On average, how many people do we need to be hiring per month? And we were able to start putting together metrics that would allow us to know, are we on track as managers? Are we moving in the right direction to hit these goals? Instead of, hey, I want to do $10 million in revenue next year, but not putting into like context, well, like how many people does that mean we need? And how many pieces of equipment do we need? And all of those types of things.
Now, when you're saying figuring out cost per employee, does office staff come into that?
Yeah, that's full-time employees. There's two metrics.
Everybody.
There's two metrics. Some people will do salaried versus hourly. I prefer to use everybody. And the reason I prefer to do everybody is I want to know what the total employee count is. And then we also had an idea based off of revenue size, like, hey, for us, an estimator needed to be responsible for between 20 and 30 million in revenue. And our estimator would have a full-time takeoff technician. So like they weren't doing takeoffs. They had somebody that was doing takeoffs for them. 100%
of the time. You need to that size.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you alluded to this at the beginning, which is, hey, we're growing. We went from this size to this size. Now I'm trying to figure out how do we keep the work in front of us? Like the bigger the machine, the hungrier it is.
Oh, stiff.
So we were doing 4 million in revenue when I kind of got brought in to start taking over when my dad was sick. When I left, we were billing between $6 and $9 million a month. And so all it does is like what we needed in a year to feed, we had to have every month. And so just everything becomes more. You have to estimate more projects because good estimates is important, but I think the number of estimates is probably just as important. Like you have to get enough estimates out there because if you put together a good estimate, you're just not going to win probably more than like 30% of the time. I'm sure someone will listen to this and argue with me on that. But I think somewhere around a third of the time, if you're winning that many estimates, you're doing really good. And I wouldn't even be concerned if you were winning like 15% of your estimates. Anywhere in that range, I feel like you're in a pretty good spot. You'll definitely have times where, you know, maybe you'll win quite a few, then maybe you'll lose quite a few in a row. So if you look at any given month, that number might be skewed, but you shouldn't be winning 50% or more of your bids or else.
You need to raise your prices.
Hang on. Yeah.
It's weird because like, you know, like you were saying, I kind of alluded to, you know, now we have this big hungry machine, you know, needs to be fed. It's difficult. And I'm not playing a victim like, oh, this is poor me, but it's difficult here in Canada because, you know, come right now to about May, which is a long time, the work really slows up and everybody else who has this big machine to feed, their margins start getting lower, lower on the jobs. And then you get your bid results back and you're like, okay, well, that's almost cost because everyone just wants to keep rolling, right? Everyone just wants to keep stuff going. So it's like this fine line of like, okay, we need to grow, but you need to ensure that you have that constant feed of connections or a network of people that can feed you that work and you can estimate it and win it and then execute it. It's like this crazy cycle that I just stay asleep at night looking at the ceiling. It's like, oh boy, like, let's go.
You're not alone in that. One thing that we did and we were successful in it and, you know, maybe it can be replicated, maybe not, I don't know. But because I guess the more people that think this way, the harder it would be to replicate. But we felt really strongly that we were going to win our work after everybody else got full. Like, everyone has a construction season, even in Arizona, believe it or not, we get busier in the summer. It just is.
Really?
Yeah. Which sucks because it's freaking hot outside. But I'd say even in Arizona, June to September, October are busy. Our biggest billing month is usually October is the biggest billing month for us. There's probably a lot of reasons why, but so what we would do is early in the season, like January through March, April, we wouldn't win as much. And it was mostly because like we knew we wanted our margin. And the first year we did this, it was really, really scary because that means you don't have as much revenue, right? But then as we moved into the summer, we said, all right, everyone else is getting full. So let's just keep our margin where we want it to be and let's go win all this work. So we tried to make 12% net. Our overhead was around,
after all said and done.
Yeah. Our overhead was between 8 and 9.5%. And so like all in, we were like 9.3% is what we thought. So we're bidding around 21% markup, trying to push 12 to 13 before tax. So earnings before tax. We would just basically say like, hey, in the summertime, a lot of people, they start adding like, oh, we're busy. Let's add a few points to this. We just said, well, what if we just keep our margin where we want all through the summer and even when we're slow? And what if we start winning 50% of our work at a greater margin than we would if we got it in the winter? And then we won what we normally would in the summer anyways. I think something as simple as that ended up adding up to a fair amount of additional profit. And it took us several years to get to where we could do that. Don't listen to this podcast and be like, hey, I'm going to just like raise my price and I'm not going to win any work in the spring. Like, I'm not saying that, but
that's not an option. We need the capital.
But remember, if you win work at low margin, now your assets and your resources are tied up on that low margin work and you're going to miss out on higher margin work. So be careful about taking low margin work.
Yeah, it's such a fine thread, you know, because like we're at the point, and like I'm third generation business and people are always, I think from the outside, maybe looking in, it's like, oh, yeah, they got nothing to worry about. There's probably a honeypot somewhere, you know, that, but it's not the case. And like, it's scary because yeah, if there ended up never being any work, like, or coming knocking on the doors and we're closing up shop, you know, like it's hard because when you're growing, it requires so much capital and construction to grow. It's so overhead orientated. So it's kind of like you need so much money to grow, in my opinion, in construction. And it's tough because then, you know, you look at it, it's like, if we don't get, you don't get work for 2 or 3 months, everything's kind of depleted. And then like, okay, what are you going to do? You know, so it's just this constant grind of like, yes, we need higher margins and I would love to do that. But at the same time, what's better, zero revenue or, you know what I mean?
It's really difficult. It's like, it's as much art as it is science. So like you use the metrics and the numbers to try and inform making good business decisions, but there comes a fair amount that comes down to like, hey, it's gut and it's experience that gets you the rest of the way there. I just say like, in general, no, when I take low margin work, it's going to use resources. If you look and say, I don't have any other opportunities out there to put those resources on, it probably makes sense to take that work. But if it's in April and you're like, hey, I'm going to take this 3 month long project, it's super low margin, but I'm kind of slow right now, I need to take it. Well, now in May and June, when the better opportunities come, your resources are tied up and you can't get to it. So that's where it's like, use the numbers, but then also weigh some of that experience and say like, okay, I know that's a 3 month project. What if I pass on this one? Is there any other opportunities out there that are maybe a 3 or 6 week project that doesn't get me locked into that low margin work when I know I'll, you know, the chances of me getting better margin work are a lot higher.
Yeah. Gave me a lot to think about here. You understand. And that's what I like is because I can talk to an accountant, you know, sometimes and it's like, well, they've never owned a construction business or ran a construction business, although they know the laws and taxes and stuff. Like to actually talk to somebody that understands this kind of language, but also owned and ran a construction business, I think it's two different conversations because it's like, no, I get it. Like what I'm saying is ideal, but this is kind of where we have to fall to make it work.
Yeah, exactly. One thing that's really cool about what I, you know, what we call the dirt world. So mining, construction, infrastructure in general. I think there's a lot of people out there who are willing to help. And yeah, my wife was sick for the last week and we were in the hospital. And even that, like the number of people who reached out who are wanting to help. So, you know, hopefully if people are listening to this podcast and they feel like they need help, like, no, I'm Randy at buildbit.com. Shoot me questions. We do have a consulting service where we'll consult, but mostly just if you need a quick response to an email or want a quick phone call, we jump on all the time to try and help out because we've been there. We know what it's like to not know how you're going to make payroll this week because you had to pay for fuel and somebody hasn't paid you and your fuel bill was 80 grand. That sucks.
Yeah, I can relate very well to that.
I'll tell you this, it's a long game, but taking care of the business and making sure the business is taken care of often means that the owners have to have delayed gratification. I never owned a boat, and I'm not saying that you can't. I'm just saying I never owned a boat. I never owned an RV because I was at the time the business was growing. And so all the capital ended up being in the business. But as we learned metrics, we realized about how much cash we needed in the business. We worked really hard to get to a level where we had millions of cash in the business. Near the end of my stay there, we had a 3 million plus balance in the business at all times.
Jeez.
It got really big at times. But because we were good about taking care of the business for a decade, we started to learn what we needed to do. And then we started doing it for a decade. Then it got to a point where I was able to take massive draws out of the business because the cash got to where the business was taken care of. So my saying is take care of the business and the business will take care of you. So often we try and take care of ourselves and we're surprised when the business doesn't last. If you put the business first, and when I say stuff like this, it's a generalization. So nobody think I'm saying like, hey, your mental health is worth less than taking care of the business. That's not the case, clearly. But that delayed gratification financially to make sure the business is good is going to pay huge dividends in returns. I made a lot of money owning that business and then selling that business that I would never have had I been worried about how much money can I take out of the business.
That's awesome.
That's my soapbox, I guess.
And then, yeah, dude, I love it. That's kind of like just the stuff that you need to hear. And I know that I feel like this was like an hour long consulting fee I did not have to pay for to Randy. But I know deep down that there's so many other people that listen to this podcast that are in the exact same boat or are going to be in that exact same boat going, dude, fine. Somebody's asking and being open and talking and asking about this stuff because it's hard to find this information online. Because when you Google, what should be in my overhead for a construction company? It's so hard to find an answer because it's all like, well, if you want a brick and mortar retail store and you buy your clothes. And I'm like, I don't have a brick and mortar store that owns clothes. I have a construction company with fuel costs and a building and payments and so many different variables.
I think the biggest thing is if they have those questions, reach out. If we can't answer them, we can point them in the direction of some webinar series or consulting. Nobody needs to be alone in trying to figure out how to go manage this. The way we change the dirt world, really, at BuildBit, we're all about training and development and telling the story of the dirt world. And we see kind of all that as one mission of making this an industry where people want to be. Believe it or not, making and helping the businesses become more profitable is a big part of that. Like if you want to be able to invest in a training program and you want to be able to invest in all this, like we can't have businesses that are operating at 2% margin. It makes it really hard to invest in competitive benefits and competitive training programs and that kind of stuff. So this is the kind of stuff that although, you know, we are seen as maybe a marketing company or a marketing and a software company, our care for the dirt world really is how do we make the people in the dirt world succeed, whether that's business owners or that's somebody who's entering the industry new and wants to grow into become an operator or a foreman or a project manager, etc.
I cannot wait for everyone on my team to even listen to this podcast. So thank you for coming on today, Randy. I really appreciate it.
No problem, man.
This has been a podcast brought to you by our good friends over at Komatsu. We will catch you guys on the next one. Make sure to subscribe, like the podcast, whatever you got to do. Catch you on the next one. Take care. See you, Randy.
Thanks, guys.